रवे गौरचंद्राय राधिकाय तदालय कृष्णाय कृष्ण भक्ताय तत् भक्ताय नमो नमः. So welcome to all of you, Pranam. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you, Vincent and Jennifer, for hosting us, and Nimai for holding this space. That's a very important word, spaciousness. Creating spaciousness, not just the physical place, geographical space, but the inner holding of space, which allows us to hopefully to be who we are and to be willing to explore all that we can be. Of course, before being all that we can be, we have to be all that we can be now. All that we could be, that's something else, but all that we can be in the here and now. So I'm glad to be in a space like this, which is inviting for, yeah, honesty and sincerity, which at the end of the day is what characterizes in our tradition a sadhu, or a person of deep authenticity. At the end of the day, as we were talking the other day, we don't want to be, our tradition is not so much about perfection, but perfection about honesty. We're trying to be as authentic and transparent as possible. So today, in an attempt of being honest, today I've been invited to talk about a book that I published last year. It's my third book. So I've been traveling and publishing and presenting my book around the world, but since it's the first time I'm coming to the Netherlands, I'm presenting my book in the Netherlands today. Why not? It's never late. So we'll be sharing a few thoughts about my book. I have it here. It's called, my book. I don't want to sound too much like owning my own book, but somehow I had to put my name below. So it's called Evolution in Divine Love, The Eternal Becoming of God, Soul, and Matter. And I've been talking about this book for a long time, but the very main topic of the book allows me to continue talking about it, because the topic of the book is how everything is in evolution, everything is growing, everything is evolving, everything is expanding. So there is no final closure to anything. Whether we speak about love, speak about God, speak about us, consciousness, the soul, and its potential, whether even we speak about material energy. So the book is divided in four parts, one dedicated to love as ever evolving, one dedicated to the divine as always in development and expansion in love, dedicated to us with an ever evolving potential, and finally to the so-called realm of so-called inert matter, which is not as inert as we think, the more we pay attention to it. So yeah, my book tries to make a case based on my Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, or our Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition for some of us, but also connecting with different mystical wisdom traditions as well, tries to make a case for keeping life, I will say, exciting, because we don't want life, boring life. And if we try to speak in terms of, okay, things begin here and end here, you reach here, this is perfection, game over, nothing else, nothing new else to learn, to grow, at least for me, that's boring. No? And our tradition will agree with that. I'll say, yeah, that's boring. We want an exciting eternity, starting here and now, as we talked yesterday, an exciting life, full of discovery, full of wonder, full of childlike spirit, like not only the Bible says, but also the Rig Veda says exactly the same thing. Only those who are childlike can enter into the kingdom of God. That's also in the Rig Veda, interestingly enough. I just came to know recently. So being childlike is not the same as being childish, right? So childlike means remaining open to learning and discovery and wonder. No? We don't have now our little Nimai here, but he's a very important reminder to all of us so-called adults, very serious people we are, to go back to play, to go back to innocence and naivety and rediscovering things and not taking things for granted, right? Because sometimes in spiritual circles we had a PhD in that. become experts at certitude, at certainty. I know all, I have all the answers to all the questions. I know everything. Ask me whatever you want. I have the full answer for you. And we forget, hey guys, we are dealing with the infinite here. No matter how you want to call it, personal, even impersonal, Madhuri, Aishwarya, Krishna, Narayan, Lakshmi, secondary, but it's the infinite. So how much can I bring closure to the infinite? That's a contradiction of terms. How can I fully grasp, understand the infinite? We can just, as Srila Siddhar Maharaj will say, one of my teachers, you can just touch one point of the infinite. And just one, that point will be overwhelming for you. That one point of the infinite will completely leave you captured forever. Or to speak of the totality of it, there's no totality like a fixed final number. It's not like 100%. That's why, interestingly, as I also mentioned in my book, when in our tradition we try to speak about God in numerical terms, sometimes tradition use numbers for God or even numbers for sometimes the devil, 666. In our tradition, whenever you speak about the divine, you use 108. So that's an interesting number unto itself, because it points 100, which for us 100 means full, no? Complete, 100%, plus. No? Complete plus, no? Something else, 108. An 8, if you turn the 8 like this, what do you have?
Symbol of infinity.
You are saying that, I'm not saying that. Right? So 100, full, complete, plus infinity. No? Like trying to say, hey guys, stop counting. No? 100, 109, and to infinity. So our idea is not trying to understand even God, but trying to love the divine, trying to love everything. And love doesn't care for understanding. In our particular tradition, the topmost lovers of the divine, of Radha and Krishna, are the inhabitants of a land called Vrindavan, and they don't care for understanding anything. Their bhakti, their love is called Jnana Shunya Bhakti, or love devoid of the necessity of knowledge. They love so much that the heart is so active, from the neck up, we don't need to do much work. But many of us here, over here, get stuck from the neck up. We get like strangulated here, like suffocated here. Many times spiritual life is a unlearning and a deconstruction, so we can thread the endless 20 centimeters from brain to heart. Let's go down a little bit. So we are invited to contact the infinite and to understand that, interestingly enough, if we are talking about the infinite, an aspect of the infinite is that the infinite is everywhere, right? Because if I say the infinite is not here, then it's no longer infinite. So if the infinite, and we call the infinite perfection. So the infinite is perfection. Perfection is everywhere. The infinite is everywhere. That's an important point I try to make in my book about starting here and now. As yesterday we were talking, and we had a sharing with some Franciscan brothers, and one sister at least I saw, one Franciscan sister, and many other sisters, some of you. We were talking about, rather than dreaming with a perfect land in the paradise, in eternity, in heaven, in spiritual world, however you would like to call it, that has to begin here and now. We have to start to live a life that we want to live in eternity. I cannot live my life here in this direction, and I want to live a life in eternity in this particular way. We start to live in eternity here and now. Hopefully we start to have glimpses of eternity here and now. When we feel, hopefully, like when we were doing kirtan, I was like, oh, we could be doing this forever. That's a glimpse of eternity. We could be doing this forever. I'm fine with that. We don't want to go to an eternity when we are expected to do things that we don't want to do forever. Who wants to go there? And many people do not want to go there because they have a wrong idea of eternity. So that if that's eternity, I stay here. I'm fine with samsara over and over again. It's okay. Right? Because you are giving me such a sometimes boring, dead idea of eternity or I don't know, whatever idea. I'm not going there. I'm staying here. As ups and downs that it may be, it somehow it's more exciting. So that's why we need sometimes to get a more coherent picture of eternity. So it's relatable to us. And we actually are, if we are practicing spirituality, we are practicing voluntarily, intentionally, because we want to reach that state of consciousness. Not because of pressure or fear or so whatever, what public opinion, but because I choose to. Because I cannot not do that. At one point, our lifestyle should be irresistible. The idea, hopefully, some of you are practicing some form of spiritual life, if I ask you why you are doing that, hopefully your answer is because I cannot not do it. Maybe it's not the moment yet, but hopefully we'll reach a place that we say, because I cannot not do it. It's too fascinating not to do it. It's irresistible. That's ideally our path. Our path is, we call it the path of fascination. Not so much the path of regulation. Do this, don't do that. If you fail doing that, this will happen to you. These are the consequences. So you better straight up. This is waiting for you. That's not the ideal motivation we want to embrace. It's one of, again, wonder, fascination, irresistible attraction. One of the names for the sweet absolutes, for the divine, our tradition is Krishna, which means irresistibly attractive. So you cannot resist. And we are very expert at resisting so much stuff. That's a second PhD we have. We spoke about the other one, but this is a PhD at denial, resistance. But this is someone who is so attractive that it disarms you. But again, we need to actually enter in touch with that actual person that is irresistibly attractive. Sometimes, unfortunately, in the name of Krishna, in the name of an irresistibly attractive divine, we misrepresent that reality and speak about God in ways that are not very attractive. Sometimes they're even scary. So we are not doing a service to to the divine by misrepresenting the divine. So gradually it's important that we get a coherent idea of the divine. Let's put it in common sense. An idea that makes sense. An idea that is not unbelievable. That is so weird and strange that it's unbelievable. I cannot believe that. Like some atheist friends tell me, I don't believe in God. Why not? What's the God you don't believe in? This. I don't believe in that one either. That's a very bizarre guy. That's unbelievable. Now, maybe there's another idea of the divine that is more, not only believable, because we are not here about to believe things, but to experience something undeniable, right? So basically, this book is all about that, trying to depict a coherent idea of what is love, what is bhakti, what is the divine, who we are, in ways that are healthy, sustainable, and give hope and give prospect to a never-ending process of growth. It's not like there is a point that I graduated from bhakti or I attained my retirement from spirituality, nothing else to learn, nothing else to do. Can become complacent. No, we're invited to become students forever. And the infinite is everywhere, so even every single aspect of reality has so much to teach. And one of our main teachers, and for us a very unique expression of the divine, Sri Chaitanya Dev, he will say, well, I look at the blade of grass, I see a guru. I look at the tree, I see another guru. I look at, and the verse could have continued. I look at the rose, I see a guru, and I look at the mosquito. Yeah, even the mosquito. The female mosquitoes who are the ones who bite you. I see a guru. Right? Srimad Bhagavatam, in one of our main texts, there's a list of 24 gurus. The funny thing, and very interesting one, is like, 21 are non-humans. And of the three who are humans, one is a baby, second is a girl, and the third is a prostitute. Interestingly, there is no caste-born Hindu Brahmin, long beard, big turban, Sanskrit scholar, charismatic Kirtaniya, just, yeah, sun, deer, snake, prostitute, all of them can be your guru. And the point is, you can learn from everything and everyone, especially those you think you cannot learn anything from. Especially those ordinary, quote-unquote, ordinary people, ordinary life circumstances, those moments in your day that you feel, today I'm at my most ordinary. Not maybe because you want, but you find yourself in a moment that you don't feel, oh, this is my most glorious moment. No, still you can learn from that. Mm-hmm. Guru is everywhere, finally. Krishna is the original guru. Krishna is everywhere. Guru is everywhere. It's up to us to become good students and develop the eye of a disciple that finds guru everywhere. One of our teachers, Sanatana Goswami, will say, if you learn to relate to a blade of grass for what the blade of grass actually is, you attain all perfection. That's a very unusual sadhana he's prescribing. He's saying basically go to the backyard and speak to the grass. It's like, what? Are you crazy? We don't speak to the grass. And on top of that, the grass doesn't speak to us. Well, tell that to Sri Chaitanya, no? Trinada Pisunichena. He's seen the grass, he's seen, wow, so much humility. The whole PhD in humility is coming to me through that blade of grass. So the whole idea is to gradually, sustainably learn to see, learn to listen, align with reality so we realize how much aliveness there is everywhere, how much teaching, how much information, how much revelation is happening all the time everywhere. Mm-hmm. Learning to walk in life with a pace that allows us to listen. Because sometimes we may go too fast and we miss the lessons. Mm-hmm. Especially the times we are living now. Everything gets faster and faster, and we receive so much, but we don't process, we do not internalize what we are receiving. So it's important to slow down as much as possible, as much as we can. Not scroll down, slow down, in case you listen, if you are accustomed to listen the other word. Is, I didn't say scroll down, but slow down. Slow down the scroll down. And you start to perceive so many other things in between the lines. And you can capture so many of the hints that are being thrown at you every single moment. And that's the idea of being part of a spiritual tradition. And that's what I want to share with you today. A few ideas on this word tradition, especially inspired from a few experiences from yesterday with our Franciscan brothers and sisters. We went to visit them and had a nice gathering there. And at one point I was talking with one monk, Brother Ferdinand. I'm pronouncing it correctly. Okay. Yeah. I don't have a PhD in Dutch. Again, I have a PhD in certainty, in trying to measure reality and all those embarrassing things. But a Dutch Ferdinand. Something like that. Okay, there you have it. For the Orthodox ones we have here, Vincent supporting it. Now we were talking about tradition, and how for many of us the word tradition is not so interesting. It sounds like old, some old stuff, something from the past, something dusty, from who knows where, outdated, something that does not speak to me in the present moment, in my current circumstance, something that is not relatable, something that was spoken, revealed some thousands of years ago in a certain culture by certain people that I have nothing to do with, or with tradition. But actually that's not the meaning of tradition, right? Yesterday talking with Brother, he told me, I didn't know that. I always love to learn the etymology of words, the meaning of words, but I didn't know this one with tradition, which actually means like giving across. No? The Latin, the original Latin has to do with giving across and like passing something, no? And sharing with others and continuing the path. It's not like I give you something and that's the end. but it's an ongoing, not passing on to something else, which is what keeps the tradition alive. Again, the tradition is not about something was said 5,000 years ago. You just learn those lines, copy paste, parrot them, and you are a bona fide member of the tradition. No, you have to, not only you have to pass down the copy paste thing, but you have to pass down your experience of that, your contribution, your realizations to that. So that will be enhanced. Something else will become, something new will become to that. So in my book, I talk about tradition, and my book is about evolution and things being ever new. So if you allow me, I'd like to show one short section, brief. I promise it won't be long. On tradition, in connection of the title of the sections seems to be a little bit counterintuitive. It says preserving tradition by breaking new ground. Because again, sometimes when we think preserve tradition is keep it as it is, nothing changed, always the same. But the actual preservation of a tradition is breaking new ground. Not breaking the tradition, but adding to continue to ornament that. So it says, this is an introduction. There is always a dual obligation to preserve what has been handed down and to pioneer new paths forward. These are not contradictory actions, but complementary. They ground us in the timeless aspects of our faith while simultaneously pushing us into the ongoing evolution that infuses all things. However, when preservation is confused with a rigid adherence to the past and change is seen as deviation, which happens quite often, the tradition risks becoming irrelevant, a relic rather than a living source of inspiration, static rather than ecstatic. The real challenge, therefore, is to keep the current current. Making a play of words there in English. The current current, like updated. Because tradition is a current, it's a flow, something that is coming, is descending. So that's an important challenge and invitation. Of course, if someone joins a tradition, you first need to have an idea. Learn what the tradition is about before thinking about making your own contribution and to the tradition. First, what's the tradition, right? So we may need to spend some time first being grounded in whatever school lineage, but eventually you will be expected to make some contribution. Like once one of our teachers, Srila Prabhupada, he had recently published by that time a translation commentary to the Bhagavad Gita. So it was published, and he had been published other books. So his students asked him, knowing, okay, what's the next book? And they knew, okay, what's someone else, some other book will be coming after. So they asked him, so what's the next book you're thinking about publishing? He said, maybe I can write a commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. On the disciple. Mm-hmm. He had just published Commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. So, no, you just published the Commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. And he kind of chuckled, like, that was basically his answer, like saying, you don't get it. No. One can write endless commentaries to the Bhagavad Gita. It's not that there's a final word. Okay, this is a commentary, nobody else can say anything else. I could write a second and a third and a fourth and a fifth. And then he will say, when I'm no longer here, the duty of every student, if they write at all, is to write something new, not to just copy paste what has been, but to ornament and embellish in this what has been revealed and continue to share that. So actually that's tradition. Again, tradition is not something outdated, like a museum piece, like a relic from the past. Sometimes I can understand some people may become concerned, fearful, like we don't want to change anything because if we change something, there's the risk of deviation. It's understandable. That has happened as well. But the other risk is because if no things change or no things improved or adjusted, the whole thing becomes irrelevant. You cannot relate to that anymore. It's like it's not speaking my language. Outdated, like an app. You know, in your phone, you have apps that you need to use. If at some point it will say, you need to download the latest version of this. If not, your phone is not operative. So you may insist, no, I will keep the old school, ancient, traditional version of the app. And probably it doesn't stop working. It's just... So in the same way, of course, ancient traditions and original revelation from different schools are all to be properly honored and venerated. But as we say before, all these traditions are trying to say something about the infinite. So trying to say something and always something else. And there's no end to how much you can say to the infinite. So we can always say something more. Proper representation of the tradition is not say less from your previous teachers. Or maximum say the same thing, copy paste, or less. No, try to say something more. Because the topic is infinity, no? Eternity, so to say. So yeah, any genuine spiritual tradition or lineage is about that, trying to keep things up to date, relevant, relatable, not only adjusting the language to the times we are living, that's very important. That's very important. Using proper analogies, not only to the times, but to the cultures we are living. We were talking the other day with Vincent about that, about Rama and the lotus talk and certain symbols coming more, like we could say, from a Hindu background, if you want to use it, that idea. And for someone with a Western psyche, they may need some more Western symbology to understand the same principle. And it's fine. We are not compromising the essence of the teaching. We are just adjusting the packaging so it's like more relatable. Like if in some circles you will be taken more seriously if you are appearing like with suit and tie. And if I appear dressed as a tribal member of an African village, they may like, oh. And my message will be compromised because they will be like already prejudiced about my appearance. So we need to adjust the packaging sometimes so the essence is not compromised. But also, again, the duty of a tradition is to bring new insects, bring new gifts, like a family, father, son. Thanks for coming. No problem. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Pleasure to have you. Thank you. Okay, that's the sound of goodbye here. So in any family, we have newcomers, right? Your mom, your dad, son comes, grandson comes. They are all bringing their own contribution, and also they are bringing their own messiness. Well, that's also part of any tradition you inherit. As I like to say, we inherit both treasure and trouble. Because let's be honest, despite the pure spiritual revelation of a tradition, there's also the relative side of a tradition. Human beings, institutions, staff, history, relationships. So we join a particular tradition. We are also connecting, plugging into a source of wisdom, but also some inheritance of unresolved trauma from the previous generation that you need to be aware of so you can deal about that. So you don't think it's your own thing. It's coming. The other day I was talking with a friend in the United States, and she told me, speaking about African tribes, she had a friend, he's from an African tribe, and he will say that in the tribe he is part of, the kids are very early introduced to, how to say, all the truths about their family and ancestors, like your mama, your dad, and your grandfather. They're beautiful, they are great, but also this happened, they have this happened. So they show that openly to them so they can understand those things in from their family that are in them, the inheritance they are with. So whenever they see that, they realize, well, actually, it's not me. This is part of the inheritance of being born. And I'm invited to heal that. That's my contribution to the tribe. So that's also a service opportunity. No? Just for us to be also not naive and think, no, I'm joining spiritual lineage and I don't want any type of messiness in any group. I just want pure, sheer ananda, bliss, and be floating. Like one time, one devotee told me very, in a comic way, like she, but he told me, no, on the day when I joined, I thought, I will be floating in an ocean of ananda for eternity. Like, how long does it, how long did the honeymoon last today? Like, a few days only. So, yeah, we bring our own stuff, but also you join a family, you join a group, there is unresolved stuff. Just to normalize it, not to feel bad about it. So it's good that we become aware of that. And when we join a tradition, we also have to see, well, okay, what needs to be healed here? No. What do I need to heal? What needs to be healed? Because if not, sometimes we have this notion, our tradition of parampara, which basically means the same thing as tradition. As I say before, tradition means to hand over, to give across. And parampara means parampara, one after another. Parampara, one after another, passing wisdom. But again, passing wisdom, but sometimes some other things are being passed in the process. Some cultural prejudice, some wounds from childhood, some unresolved trauma, whatever. And that becomes part of the parampara, interestingly. And we sometimes may receive something and think, oh, I'm absolutizing this thing that is coming to me like part of the parampara revelation. And sometimes it's something that I need to heal in the lineage. Which I know it sounds a little strange, like who am I to heal the lineage? I'm coming to a lineage to be healed. And I understand in the beginning we may not even think about healing my own lineage. But eventually, we will be called to that service. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says the duty, one of our teachers, the duty of every member of a sampradaya, another word for a lineage, is to free the sampradaya from the anarthas that it may have. He's using that word, anartha, which in Sanskrit means like false value, actually means. Artha means value and anartha means false value, like false beliefs, false ideas that somehow they became normalized as the truth. That happens again. Superstitions and cultural prejudice or some relative ideas that have been absolutized. And our teacher, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, will say, if you join a lineage, it's your duty, at some point at least, maybe not on day one, but at some point you should serve your community in some way, no? like any one of us. We are born as a baby. Of course, we are not expected to serve back the community in the Netherlands when I am 1 month old, right? I need everyone to serve me, feed me, change my diapers, put me to sleep, serve me. It's fine. Eventually, the idea is like everything starts to balance and we offer something back. No? The father will say to the baby, how do you say? Thank you. Good. Very good. Thanks. Start to acknowledge that there is someone else, some reciprocity. Thank you. How do you say? Please. Do you want to wash the dishes? Just gradually try to become a contributor to the community. So it all starts with washing the dishes at 4 years old or whatever. Yeah, because if you do not gradually make the person enter into that mode, you become basically self-centered narcissistic monster and everything is about you and everyone is to be served and I don't ask me anything from me. So the same with spiritual lineage. It's like entering a family. The first years you may be breastfed, you are not demanded to think about how to heal your own lineage, but as you grow into a family, also in the beginning we were like, as babies, it's like, oh, mom and dad are gods. That's how a baby thinks. First mom, there's nothing else but mom, the goddess. Then we see the god, also dad, the divine couple. And we deify them, absolutize mom and dad, superheroes. Well, like I remember one research done with kids of maybe 2, 3, 4 years old, and they were inviting the kids to play different games. And at one point they will ask all the kids, so do you know who invented this game? And all of them naturally say, or mom or dad, of course. No? They are the creators of the universe. Whatever exists, of course they created that. The smartest people on earth, most perfect, the most beautiful. So eventually you grow and you need to be disillusioned, right? You need to realize, oh, mom and dad are beautiful. I love them, but they're also human beings and they have their shortcomings and their own trauma. And somehow eventually you realize, and they have passed on me their own trauma also. Without wanting, without any bad intention, but that's what happens in relationships. Somehow you pass on. So, but because I love them so much, okay, how can I acknowledge this, heal this, become a better version to continue honoring my ancestry, right? Serving my ancestry. And if I have kids, of course, I will pass on to them my own messiness and hopefully they continue refining and refining the lineage. So that's not only the case with our biological family. That's also the case with the spiritual family. Because it's not that everyone in a spiritual family is absolutely free from all shortcomings. So eventually we're invited to make our contribution. How do we want to serve your lineage? What healing is required? What type of healing you can provide? This question that maybe we never asked before. I have to heal my lineage? Wow. How? What to do? How to embody? What do I need to embody to make this particular lineage? And not hopefully not only the lineage, but the whole world, something more wholesome, more healed. We need so much healing. So that's a service opportunity. Again, that's not a problem. That's not like, oh, there's wounds to heal. Oh, there's trauma to resolve. Ooh. I mean, that means we are becoming more realistic, more acquainted with reality. So our spirituality also can become more grounded and not so much only about lofty ideas in transcendence, but also embodiment, grounded psycho-emotional balance, being a functional human being. That's all part of the spiritual project. We don't want to be perfectly pure divine beings and totally dysfunctional human beings. That's not the idea. We want to serve, in our traditionalist, we want to serve Radha and Krishna in Vrindavan. Their lila is called Nara Lila. Nara Lila means fully divine, fully human also. So if I'm half-baked human here, how do I expect to enter a place that is fully human? So part of my service project is, how do I increase my humanness? Especially in a time where inhumanness is becoming the norm and AI is more human than most humans. So you have to preserve your humanness, because if not, whenever technology shows some humanness, you cannot see the difference because it looks more human. So it's important to remain in touch with our humanity, to honor that, to divinize it, fully human, fully divine. That's a very sweet spot. So anyhow, those are some of the topics that I tried to share in these few pages, among others. I just touched one little point regarding tradition. Again, tradition is not so much like a club. No, like I become a club member and I receive my card and I have my fancy card, membership card. Hey, I was initiated in this tradition. This is my new name. And I was given this set of things that I have on my neck. And it's fine. Honeymoon period. Celebrate your membership card. But at one point it's like, how do you want to serve? How do you want to heal? There is healing needed here in the family, in the lineage, in the ancestry. How do we commit ourselves to grow together? And that's ever evolving. There's always something new to learn, something new to heal. That's how we progress in the world of love. Because our goal is love. And love is not just, love ideally is unconditional. It's not so much, I love you only when you are pure and perfect and when you are not a mess and when you are divinely transcendental, then I love you. No. We are not being loved in that way by God. We are already loved unconditionally with all our ups and downs in between. We are already fully loved and accepted. So we are invited to return the same quality of love. It's an art and it may take lifetimes. So relax also. No rush. Takes time. But that's a beautiful invitation, you know, and that all starts between each one of us, also in our daily relationships, how we learn to love and accept each other compassionately, empathically, ourselves. That's another lecture. We need a separate one. Self-acceptance, as we were saying the other day. You know, I cannot speak about love for God and for humanity while at the same time I despise and hate myself. That's absolutely contradictory. Love has to be coherent. And coherence in love means love remains loving in every direction. It's not that I love you, you, I hate you. No. Love has to be equally loving north, south, east, west, and all the other points in between. So how to love the divine and love everyone and love myself gradually, more and more unconditionally, without doing away with my humanity. And healing whatever needs to be healed, whatever healing modality may be necessary in service to Bhakti, it's okay. It's not like, oh, you're going to the psychologist. Wow, you have so little faith in the holy name. That means that if I cut my arm, I just have to chant double number of rounds and the blood will disappear. And I don't need to go to a doctor. I mean, faith is everything. Come on. We have to be practical. So whatever we need to keep our psychophysical vehicle healthy, balanced, all that can be an offering also as part of bhakti. So we can relate in functional, realistic, empathic, beautiful ways to this path of ever-evolving love. So those are a few thoughts I want to share today with you. And also, we have a few more minutes in case anyone has a question or anything you would like to share, any reflections, any doubts. You can totally disagree with everything I've said so far. Feel free to do so. Fine. I'm not coming here for everyone to say Maharaj Ki Jai. That will be so boring. So you can bring some spice into the masala, no problem.
I would like to add something.
Yes, please. What's your name, sorry, again?
Frank.
Frank, thank you.
In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, whatever you forget or whatever you remember, it comes from me, from Krishna. Mm-hmm. And I realize myself this in my life. It's rather emotional because this is so simple. When I get out of my house, I forget to close the window, and then I walk out, and there's a voice in my head that says, "You forgot to close the window." And then I get in, and I realize myself, that's not me. I was forgetting something, so. There was a voice in my head, that's not me. And then I closed the window, of course, and I went out. And then I realized myself, why did he let me forget this? That's the second question. And then I realized myself, this is Krishna. He does this. He does this with me. And then I asked myself, why does he do this? And then I realized myself, there are thousands of reasons why he does this. But the main reason why he does this is that he wants to contact me. And me having contact with him. And it's that simple, you know? And that touches me all the time. It's so simple. It's in every day. In every moment.
Thank you for sharing. And I'm very glad that all that you were sharing finished in this idea of he wants to contact me. Because we could go into so many other directions, but that's the conclusion we all want, always want to converge in, finish in. Okay, there's an initiative from his side to an interest.
Yeah. You could say this is rather arrogant because God is speaking to me, you know, in the Bible, it's God speaks to me. You're a very, really special person, but in fact, we are all special persons.
That's the thing.
And it's not arrogant at all.
No. Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita in chapter 2, he says, speaking about the soul, which means you and me and each one of us, he said three times he used the word Acharya, which means amazing. So he's basically saying in that verse, you are amazing, amazing, amazing. He could go on saying more times amazing, but he has to say other verses and other things. So he's saying each one of us, not only, of course, again, it's not that we read the verse and it's, oh, that verse is only for me. I am the triple amazing person, not all of you. It's everyone. And therefore, I have good reasons to, so to say, look at myself in the mirror and say, I'm amazing. Krishna is saying that. So I cannot like contradict and say, no, Krishna, you are wrong in this verse. I have to edit the Bhagavad Gita and this verse doesn't apply. That will be arrogance. Not to suggest the absolute, you are wrong on this one. I'm not amazing. We are amazing, but we are not our own creation. So I don't have any reasons to be proud because I didn't make myself. You follow my point? It's not like I created myself and I did it so amazingly. No, I happen to be amazing. And everyone else as well. So it's not like only me. So I think it's a beautiful point of contemplation. Which is sometimes is, I appreciate you brought it because to be honest, I've talked with many people who have a big difficulty in acknowledging the amazingness of who they are because they may think that's arrogance, that's being proud. So therefore being humble means I'm stupid, I'm useless, I'm blah, 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 blah. And that's being humble and that's being miserable and that's not humility. So real humility is accepting things as they are, and things as they are humbling in themselves. You as you are amazing soul, you should be humbled by your own amazingness, which is not your creation. Yeah. And we should stay with that till it becomes natural, because in the beginning it may be more like an idea here. And then we have to leave that reality, right? But thank you for that, those words, and the, and I'm sure Krishna will keep you helping you. Will keep the window open, day after day. That seems to be his love, his daily love letter to you. Right. Yeah. And if you forget to close your window, you already know what's going on. Yeah. And again, whether it's a closed window or anything. The thing is that, right, we are constantly being approached by God. It's not like because I'm better or I'm special. Okay, I'm special, but everyone's special. I'm not better than anyone. And God, in his specialness, he can approach everyone in the deepest possible way. And we should be normalizing that more. That sometimes I'm not feeling that approach. It's not that he's not approaching, it's just that I'm not looking in the right direction, not listening. But the approach is constant. It's ongoing. Okay. One thing, and I pass the mic to you, something that came to my mind is that I think I told some of you the other day, when we were walking with Jennifer and Vincent a few days ago, that there's one name of Krishna in the Srimad Bhagavatam that it's Animisha. Animisha. Yes, yeah, the one who never blinks. So that's a beautiful name because it means like he's looking at us with so much love, with so much eagerness, with so much compassion, and so much attracted by the amazingness of what the soul is that he cannot even blink. He doesn't want to lose a nanosecond of that amazingness. So he's like Jagannath. No? Wow. No? Amazing, 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 amazing. Right? Jagannath is for me a very powerful symbol of that, right? Like big eyes, like you are being seen by God, okay? You are being held by God. You are being loved by God. No? Those three important points for me, Jagannath is a very, this is the deity at the end of the altar here for those who don't know. Like embodiment of you are being seen, you're being held, you're being loved. And again, I think it's important part of our practice and sadhana to enter into those places and to stay there enough till we start to believe it's true. And it's not believing, it's experiencing. That's true. And then you were raising your hands. Yeah.
My question is in a sense related to what you were saying and also mm-hmm. what you were also already hinting at before and also now of this self-appreciation, self-love. Mm-hmm. So this is, I recognize very much what you were saying, that for many years I was mostly like beating myself up. But also like you were saying, the in a sense, sometimes I sense that I'm a bit like, let's say, jealous about Christian practitioners who have this very close, they make this really everyday prayers, like very simple, like, you know, like, and for me, I don't know if it's probably it's a combination of my personality and also how I was learning in tradition that I somehow I would even say experiencing, because experience is in a way close by, but I would say to me Krishna was this
is showing it.
Yes, yeah. So far away and transcendent, and for me, you know, like, so I really like how you're in your lectures and your books are, you know, trying to show another show.
Yeah. And I'm not saying anything new, it's already there, right?
Yeah. But somehow the emphasis, so in the tradition, the emphasis is not so much there, and something happened in me, of course, that how I was receiving this.
Yeah, I think that's important also to say how I experience it, because maybe not everyone had the same experience. But I agree that sometimes there is, and not only in our tradition, I mean, you are being jealous, quote-unquote, of Christians, but I know so many Christians who have been traumatized by a God sent above the clouds and... Yeah. Indifferent and easily and chastising everyone.
Yeah, and this eternal hell.
On top of that, so you will find those things everywhere. That's my point. It's not about this tradition or that tradition. It's about human beings with that unresolved stuff projecting that onto God, even poor God. But yeah, I totally agree that we need to make more emphasis on the immanence of God. Transcendence also. God is transcendental, but it's also immanent. Like the Ishopanishad say, he's farther from the farthest and closer than the closest. One doesn't cancel the other. Generally, we just put the farthest on the farthest, and we say God, and we kind of go there and like throw him out of the stadium, like a home run, like outside of here. He's closer than the closest. If we want, and Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita is giving so many examples of that about nature and. Of the rivers here, of these animals, and these so many things to help us meditate. Oh, here, in the open window, everywhere, right? So many times it's about unlearning some of those ways. And many times, probably I don't want to say in your case, but sometimes those who teach us some of those things, maybe are teaching those things because they learn that, or they filter that with the learning they have in childhood. Mixed with a Christian idea, which is not a Christian idea either. And it all becomes mixed in how you present Gaudiya Vaishnavism, and then you actually learn the tradition and you realize, now that was not how, right? It's part of the process. Again, not to feel I lost my time, I was cheated. Again, like with the family, as I was saying before, you can say, oh, my parents did. Now I realize they did not give me the best ideal thing in the world. I mean, who can give that? We all are trying our best with the tools we have. So we can appreciate that, be thankful of that. And when I realize, oh, there's something better we can do, then we do it. Yeah. Thank you. You were raising your hand before?
No, I just remembered a bit, and I don't know exactly about the story with the eyelashes. Blinking of the eye. There's somewhere some story, vaguely, I think, in Srimad Bhagavatam, about gopis or the wives. I don't know exactly.
Cursing Brahma for having creating the Brahma. A few of those. There are many, more than one verse where the gopis are cursing who the hell created these eyelashes that make us blink and lose sight of our beloved for a second that feels like an eternity for them, right? Yeah. So that's a very beautiful way of showing how. That's the reciprocation, right? Because on one side there is Krishna looking in that way without blinking, and when someone loves God fully, they feel the same way. So even if there is blinking, they curse the blinking. So the point made, of course, is that like you want to really never lose sight of the object of your affection. But I think it's healthy for most of us to begin knowing that that's how we are being seen. Because if we don't, that's the main topic of my next book, which is how much we are already loved by the divine. And how on that basis of knowing myself to be loved, I can learn to love myself, to accept myself. And then on that basis, I can return the embrace to others. Because if I start with, you have to love God, but I don't know that love God loves me, I hate myself, how can I love anyone? You follow my point? Mm-hmm. If I think, no, God doesn't love me, he will only love me when I love him. Because many times we have these weird ideas. First, I have to become perfect, and then Krishna will put some attention on me. Poor Krishna, why are you making such a bad reputation of him like that? He's indifferent now, he doesn't care for you. You have to earn his attention. You have to gain merit and be perfect and perform and impress God. And then maybe, who knows, maybe he's on a good day, he will throw a silent glance to you, maybe, rather than he cannot blink while looking at you. That's a very different orientation. And again, I'm just quoting the Bhagavatam. Bhagavatam calls Bhagavan Animesha, he who never blinks. Huh? He who is like holding you with his loving glance without nonstop, 24/7. So on that foundation, I think it's way more healthy. From that place, we can practice bhakti for the right reasons. Not to gain God's love, to impress Krishna, to blah, 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 but to return the embrace. I'm already being loved. I know myself to be loved. Wow, I want to return the embrace. Naturally. It's not out of pressure. I'm not practicing out of fear, out of intimidation, but out of celebration, out of gratitude, out of wonder, like, wow, I'm loved unconditionally, infinitely, from time without beginning, without me doing anything to earn it. I mean, even in the time when I say God does not exist, blah, 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 he's still loving me. How can someone love me in that way? And then you have to feel moved to the point of tears, realizing that, right? Imagine I'm giving you just an example from this world, very material, but it's applicable to one degree. Imagine that you wake up one day and you see in your bank account someone put 1,000 euros. And you don't know who the person is. There's no name, anonymous. Probably your whole day you will be thinking, who is this person? And then you go the next day to another 1,000 euros. Then the third day, another 1,000 euros. I mean, at one point you become obsessed, like, who is this person? Who is this person? Imagine eventually you get to know who is that person. And the very first question you will have for that person is, like, why you are giving me all that money? Again, it's an example with money. Sometimes we can relate more with that. And the person said, just I want to give you that. Just because I love you. I mean, you're disarmed. You don't know what to do. You don't know what to say. Like, the only question you have is, like, how can I give you something back? I mean, if you are of a sane mind, your only concern is, like, how can I, from a place, again, from a loving place, from a place of gratitude and celebration, not from a place of guilt, of shame, but like, how can I give you something back? Right? So that should be the natural way for us to practice bhakti, that we feel we have received so much already, even before we knew, that now the only question remaining is how to serve, basically, how to give myself. You know? I remember once we were in Spain, like 3 years ago. I remember still, we had a program at Jivan Mukti Yoga in Spain, and we returned, and it was quite hot, like today. So we passed through a place that they were selling, like, I don't know, some fruit juice or something. So we stopped to get a fruit juice. They gave us fruit juice. You know, we paid for them. But we had some prasad, some food that we had cooked for the meeting that we have extra. So we were like, oh, do you want some? Like samosa or whatever, right? Like, oh, thank you. So, well, we gave one to each. Do you like? Yeah. We had a lot. So, okay, another one. Oh, nice. Another one. And at one point, they start to feel like embarrassed in the sense of like, you are giving me too much. I mean, they were happy and eating, but at one point, they were like, they were looking what they could give us back. No? So that's the natural instinct. That should be the natural way of like, when you feel you are receiving a lot, it's like, it's not like it's like an egoic competition. It's just like, okay, I also want to give. You start to feel this, the flavor of giving. So they start to give us an extra juice. And we gave an extra samosa and So that's how it works, right? And that's what Chaitanya Charitamrita says, no? It says Krishna. It's a beautiful verse which speaks a lot about what we are talking about. It's a central verse from my book here. Chaitanya Charitamrita says, Krishna is the all-attractive. That's his name. But Chaitanya Charitamrita says, the all-attractive is becoming more attractive at every moment. Imagine that. He's all the all-attractive, but the all-attractive, because he's the all-attractive, becomes even more attractive with every moment. And that makes the heart of the gopis, in this case, he says, the heart of his devotees, the love in their hearts to grow more. So the more beautiful Krishna becomes, the more loving his devotees become. And the more love they offer to him, the more beautiful he becomes because of that love. And then the more loving they become. And then the more beautiful he becomes. And the two of them, Chaitanya Charitamrita say, start a competition in which none of them accept the defeat. Right? So everyone is increasing. More love, more beauty, more love, more beauty. Back. That's the enchanted land we want to enter. Yeah, thank you for reminding us about the the non-blinking sections in our tradition. Yeah. Something else? We are almost on time, but I want also to honor if any one of you have any questions or something to share. Please. Balabi. Sorry.
So I wanted to ask, because you talked about healing. And healing, like the traumas maybe, or patterns that you have from your ancestors or from your own life. So I think it's quite difficult to know how to do that, to heal yourself. Because I tried so many things in so many years, with different success or failure to heal myself. So, how do you see this? Because if you, I mean, I agree with you that if you break your arm, you go to a doctor, and if you have something that's not working well in your mind, you go to a psychologist. But I've been to several psychologists, but I didn't have so many good experiences.
Yeah, thank you for your question. And of course, as I always like to say, I'm never using the word easy. So whatever I'm saying, I'm never saying that will be easy. Also, I'm not saying impossible, right? It's difficult.
Yeah.
And depending each case, of course, we are getting to know each other for the last 2 hours. So I don't know some of you enough to prescribe, oh, knowing you, this may help, or this healing modality, because there's not only one way of doing it. Of course, I gave psychologists as an example of that, but I'm not saying everyone should go to a psychologist. I'm not against that either, but there are many healing modalities. And sometimes, yeah, we may take maybe a little bit trial and error, as they say, not, or it may be finding your psychologist that works for you also. If it's psychology, if not, there are many other healing modalities. And so, again, it's not easy, yeah, but it's very personal. That's why I wouldn't like to give any, like, this is the way to heal for everyone in a very easy way. There's no easy way. And each one of us is very different from each other in our own journey, and what will work for one may not work for the other. What will work for us at one stage may not work for us at other stage. So it takes, yeah, openness, sincerity, trying to see what's the thing that we feel we need to heal from. And yeah, sometimes it's trying here, trying there. And it doesn't mean that sometimes also be open to how the healing will look like also, right? Because sometimes we may carry some expectation of this will happen in this way, or even thinking this is what I have to heal from, and eventually you realize that there was something else to heal from, or something deeper, and the healing will be a little bit more complex or different than how we thought the healing will take place. And maybe we are actually healing, but if we have a very, like, I'm not saying it's your case, but sometimes I've seen people having a very, like, rigid idea, this is how healing will look like, and the real healing is taking place, but they are attached to that idea, and it's never happening, right? But yeah, it takes time, it takes patience, it takes, of course, prayer, and I don't want to downplay the power of spiritual practice in all this. No, I'm not saying psychologists replace God's grace or God's unconditional love. It's again, it's complementary things. It's all in the service of the same project. Like, you are eating. It's not like you need to eat. It's not like, oh, you don't have faith in Krishna, that's why you're eating. If not, you could just live on your faith alone. You need to eat, you need to sleep, you need to go to the doctor, some may need to go to a psychologist, some this. So I think it's important at least to begin acknowledging there is place for healing, there are wounds, that spirituality heals and purifies a lot of our subconscious mind, but also sometimes we may need to access those areas more specifically, and sometimes with professional guidance to heal our psychic body. Again, as you will go to a professional doctor to heal your physical body. For me, it's kind of common sense. Again, if one modality has not worked at all or not so much, okay. We keep trying. Again, that's as much as I can speak in general without knowing someone in detail, right? So I don't want to be tempted to be more specific, because sometimes you can end up, I don't like to prescribe stuff, you know, like do this, go there, because you know, one has a hard time trying to sort out one's own situation. But there are many healing modalities, so sometimes one may not be the best for one at that time, and you can always. But many times also, again, it's also about what we were talking today, apart from things that we need to heal on a more ancestral family system level, so to say. Sometimes we also have acquired lots of trauma from religious upbringing, like lots of religious PTSD. Like some of the things we were talking today about, images of God, ideas of the divine that affect how we practice, and that reinforces maybe a trauma that we were carrying from before the practice. So by unlearning some of those things and relearning a more healthy, wholesome, empathic approach to God and spirituality, also that can heal many of those other things as well. So that's as much as I can say. Hopefully that helps. Thank you. Yes, Yashumati. We have eternity on our side, as I like to say. So.
I was thinking, how can we know that we're mature enough to really have a grasp on the tradition, mm-hmm. that it's now time to reflect on what's healthy and maybe not so healthy? Mm-hmm. Because I was thinking, from where I stand, some instructions or dynamics seem unhealthy, but then maybe I'm not getting the full picture
mm-hmm.
of where those instructions or mm-hmm. dynamics mm-hmm. are coming from or what they are intended to do.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we know that we're there?
Yeah, I mean, in one sense, there's always some space for uncertainty, right? To not be fully sure if I'm there, but also I think there's space for, on one side, trying to trust our own, that we have God-given capacities to discern those things. No? Even if I may not be using them properly or not, but at least to know I have God-given capacities to think critically and understand things properly. So that's, we're all equipped with that. How much we are using the toolkit, that's another conversation. But to trust that, because some people don't even trust that. That's my point. Some people do not even think I can think for myself ever. So I always need someone to think for me. So gradually try to reach that point of trusting yourself, right? Trusting your gut, if you will. Trusting, or as you were saying, God is in my heart also. He will remind me to close the window. So there's an inner voice that also Krishna is saying that all over the place, in the Gita and everywhere. Like, there is an inner guidance, Chaitya Guru, trusting that there is, if I'm honest, as much as I can be honest, because we can always doubt about everything, right? We can always doubt, am I being honest enough? Am I getting this? And you can doubt about doubting also, right? So for the sanity of our mind, we also have to put pause to that for a moment. Okay, if I'm feeling something, again, you are in a situation that feels strange or feels dangerous, even if you cannot explain it fully rationally, but something you tell us this is dangerous, of course you can doubt about that, and you may spend lots of time doubting, and maybe something dangerous happened. Maybe you follow that instinct, and eventually you realize, okay, that helped me, or maybe not, I was triggered by something else. Okay, you learned your lesson, you continue your journey. So I will say trusting our God-given capacities on one side, but also having feedback from other people, no? Because also we don't want just to isolate ourselves in our own way of seeing reality. Of course, at the end of the day, we have to have our own experience, right? I cannot have your experience, you cannot have mine. Nobody can impose, you feel like this, think like that. At the end of the day, I have to take responsibility for who I am. So I can try to be as honest as possible, as sincere as possible, as informed, as educated as possible, and try to grasp reality as much. There's always a bigger picture. But again, it's like a child, no? Like again, if we bring Nimai here now, Vincent and Jennifer's son, sorry for using him as an example so many times, he's an example. We have to learn from the baby. So he sees reality in a certain way. No? He sees reality in a certain way. And you could say, oh, that's not the bigger picture. If he will be 25, he will see so many things he can. Yeah, I agree. But he's seeing as much as he can see for that age. Now, if you force him to see as a 85-year-old, it will never happen. So as long as he's seeing reality as much as he can see, that's perfection. So the same, where we are now, of course, yeah, we are not seeing the bigger picture ever, because the picture keeps getting bigger. That's the main point of my book. Everything keeps evolving and expanding. So picture keeps getting bigger, so we can only touch one point of the infinite. So if I will trash myself, no, I'm not seeing the bigger picture, I'm not seeing the bigger picture. We are always missing something, but as much as I can see now, with the sincerity that I have, and with some feedback from people that I trust, no, to gain some coherent reading of reality, that's, I think, is the best thing. And then proceed accordingly. And then if we realize, oh, okay, it was not the bigger picture, or this was the thing, you can always learn from that and refine your aiming at the, no? When you're like doing archery, like aiming more in the center, okay? You can always refine your aiming. There's no end to that. So, because if not, what we will do? I will wait till everything is absolutely perfect and accurate. That's not how we learn anything. It's like saying, okay, I will only play harmonium once I'm perfect at harmonium before playing harmonium. It's like, you are ready for the madhouse. Doesn't work like that. I need to play, and I will make mistakes, and that's how you grow. And when you master some melody, no more mistakes, you need to learn something new that will be difficult enough, so you will make mistakes again. And that's how you get a bigger picture and a bigger picture. So, because if not, we end up frozen and paralyzed, and we don't take any step, any decision, any thought. So we have to work with the tools we have, as honestly as we can, hopefully with people that can share feedback in an equally honest way, and move forward, trusting that also Krishna, God in our heart, will guide our steps and shed light on whatever we are still missing in the bigger picture. Okay, if God sees the bigger picture, trusting that we will receive that insight that we need for that time. But again, the picture keeps getting bigger, so there's always room for more. Yeah. And we may look back and realize, yeah, at that time, that was not my best version of me. This was not my best decision. But you can always learn from that. So it's fine. It's okay to make mistakes also. That's an important point, to normalize failure. Not to promote failure, but to normalize, because it will happen anyway. So failure, mistakes, shortcomings, not to stigmatize them, but to normalize them as part of the learning process. Srimad Bhagavatam is full of stories with great people doing horrible things. That's a big lesson right there. Brahma, Indra, these great guys, personalities, they're doing things that's like, oops, oops. No? So the lesson there is like, yeah, do not be like terrified if that happens with other big people or with yourself. But to speak, if it happens, the idea, kaimutyanyam, is if this happens to them, what to speak of, again, not to find an excuse to keep failing, but just also to not be neurotic about I'm failing, I'm not seeing the bigger picture. Yeah, work with the tools you have, so to say, right? And everything else will come from there. Yeah. As long as there is sincerity of purpose, everything else comes from there. Srila Siddhartha Maharaj will say, sincerity is invincible. Mm-hmm. I like that line. Sincerity is invincible. You cannot be defeated if you are, even if you are imperfect, limited, and so. But if you are sincere, as much as you can be sincere, that requires some effort. Okay, how can I be the most sincere I can today, now, June 25, 11 p.m. Netherlands time? How can I be the most sincere I can at this precise moment? And that will bring all that I need to receive that I cannot get for myself. That will attract the extra grace for me to see the bigger picture that I'm not seeing yet. Trusting, having that faith, that trust. And it's true. It happens like that. I don't know if that helps. Thank you. Okay. So maybe we will put to rest the sharing. But we'll have a short Sankirtan to close. Tinaka will accompany us. And then we will share some prasad.
Yeah.
And continue sharing more informally. So thank you so much to each one of you for your time, presence, attention, questions, music offering, sharing, open and closed windows, and everything in between. Each one brings your own unique contribution to the gathering. So thank you all. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu ki jai. Sri Jagannath ki jai. Unblinking Jagannath ki jai. Gaur Premanand.